The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled State of the Art by Elaine Sciolino. In the birthplace of Italian sculpture, a powerful automated robot tries its hand at an ancient craft. To understand the magic and mystery of Carrara marble, I was told to start with a ride up a mountain. So, one crisp afternoon last spring, I donned a blue safety helmet and an orange vest and hopped into a Land Rover with Michael Bruni, a local guide. The two-way, one-lane road was badly paved, and halfway up the mountain it became a rutted track littered with rocky debris. The incline was so steep and the switchback curved so sharp that Bruni had to stop the truck before we could turn. Beneath our wheels, rocks shook and bounced the truck like a toy. Bruni explained that chunks of the mountain break off from the cliffs during heavy rainstorms or when mountain goats clamber up the slopes. He gesticulated dramatically as he told me about past disasters. "Both hands on the wheel," I said. Eventually, we arrived at a flat lookout. Cut into the mountainside, off to our right, was a base installation for water tanks, trucks, forklifts, and other heavy machinery. Workers wielding power saws cut blocks of stone 10 feet deep from the sheer face of the mountain. There was no silence, only the shrieking of machines drilling into stone. It was only when I looked out toward the jagged peaks of the Apuan Alps and saw them frosted not with snow, but with white, chalky marble, that I could appreciate the vibrant beauty of this precious stone, which has defined this part of Italy for more than 2,000 years. In antiquity, Roman enslaved workers, freemen, and convicts removed marble from these mountains with wedges and picks to build Trajan's Column and parts of the Pantheon. Great sculptors have been drawn to Carrara in centuries since, from Bernini, Canova, and Rodin, to Jean Arp and Henry Moore. But nobody is more closely associated with Carrara than Michelangelo, perhaps the greatest sculptor ever to live. In 1497, when he was only 22, he came looking for the ideal pale stone for La Pietà, the first of his Renaissance marble masterpieces, now installed at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. Bruni explained that Michelangelo spent long stretches in these hills in search of perfect blocks of marble, especially the bright white statuario, a type of pure stone nearly devoid of silica that best captures the vitality and sheen of the human form. Michelangelo cultivated relationships with excavators, cutters, and carvers, so that they would favor him with their best blocks. And he offered precise instructions about the shape and size of the marble he desired. Then, satisfied, he would hammer and chisel until the figure revealed itself. His ghost still hovers above the quarries here. You can hear the famous words attributed to the Italian master. Every block of stone has a statue inside it, and it is the task of the sculptor to discover it. The British-born, New York-based photographer, Caleb Stein, has long been fascinated with that moment of discovery, which he identifies as the point where the suggestion of a shape of a figure begins to emerge from what is still a discernible block of marble. Earlier this year, Stein learned that an industrial area outside Carrara was home to a group of up-and-coming marble sculptors, powerful automated robots belonging to a company called Litex, formerly Robotor. Stein, whose photographs often highlight the sculptural nature of the human body, traveled to Carrara to document the process of a single sculpture's creation by a robot from beginning to end, the subject of the photographs with this article. "I was interested in making intimate portraits of the robots at work," he said. "I wanted to extend tenderness and sensuality to the process, just as I would when photographing a person." Litex is the brainchild of Filippo Tincolini, a sculptor who was educated in Carrara, and Giacomo Massari, a local entrepreneur, both in their 40s. For decades, Carrara sculptors had been using small machines like electric grinders, diamond-beaded bandsaws, and pneumatic chisels. Tincolini saw an opportunity to take the process further. "My father made electrical parts for assembly lines, and though I didn't want to go into his business, I learned from him," he said. The younger Tincolini bought an automobile assembly line robot and put it to work on stone. "I didn't know how to use it, but little by little, and with a lot of marble dust, I figured out how it worked and how to improve it." Today, Tincolini, Massari, and their team of technicians and artisans create sculptures on commission for artists, architects, and designers, and they sell their technology to clients around the world, including three sizes of Litex's signature robot and a proprietary software that uses a digital scan of an artist's 3D model or maquette to auto-program the robot for sculpting. A few years ago, for example, in collaboration with the Institute for Digital Archaeology, a heritage preservation organization based in Oxford, England, their robot produced a 1/3 scale model of Sirius Palmyra Arch. The 1,800-year-old monument destroyed by Islamic State fighters in 2015. The copy, a 20-foot-high scale reproduction made of Egyptian marble, took 5 weeks to manufacture. It toured several cities around the world, including London and Washington, D.C., and is now undergoing cleaning and maintenance in Carrara. The hope is that the final destination will be near the site of the original in Palmyra. The message was, "You can destroy it, but we have the technology to make it live again," Tincoli told me. On a tour of the area, I passed through a warehouse and traditional workshop with shelves stuffed with marble funerary sculptures and crucifixes. Lining the edges of the floor were decades-old hand-carved works alongside robot-created pieces, such as a gigantic sculpture carved from black marble of a baby wearing a blindfold. Massari has his best lines down pat. "What used to take months or even years can now be done in days," he said. "Machines can run round the clock. They don't get sick or sleep or go on vacation." One of his favorite stories is about Psyche revived by Cupid's kiss. Antonio Canova's 1793 neoclassical masterpiece that sits in the Louvre. "It took Canova 5 years," Massari said. "To make a replica took our machines 270 hours, less than 12 days. When I asked Massari whether he thought Michelangelo, who like other great sculptors then and now relied on apprentices to create his masterpieces, would have used robot technology had it been available to him, Massari seemed to bridle. "Of course he would use robots, 100%. I tell people who question what we do, how did you come here? On foot, on a horse, or in a car? A car cuts time off your journey. So does a robot. An algorithm does what a caliper used to do. I have the time to contemplate a beautiful sunset because a machine does all the hard stuff." Already, Litex has made sculptures for artists, including the late Iraqi-British architect Zaha Hadid, the American Jeff Koons, and Giuseppe Pennone, a luminary of Italy's Art Povera movement. Massari opened the door to a cavernous carving studio. We're working on a masterpiece, something crazy, big, huge, he said. A very special piece. The selection of the block was crazy, because finding a pure white block is very hard. It's a famous sculptor, but we don't want to talk too much. Inside Roboter 1, the company's star robot, an 11-foot-long zinc alloy anthropomorphic arm was busy at work, milling the block by moving methodically back and forth. The arm's diamond-studded finger was spinning so fast that I couldn't see it moving, and water sprayed out from the arm, cooling the tip, which it was fashioning the intricate lacework of a woman's voluminous skirt from the stone. The final sculpture will be about 4 tons, Masari went on. The machine time is going to be 18 months. At that point, the final details will be executed by human sculptors. Even Litex's techno-evangelist owners don't pretend that its machines can match the finest subtleties of human artisanship. In an adjoining studio, I found a group of such artisans, streaked and frosted with marble powder, putting the finishing touches on several sculptures commissioned by a well-known British artist who wished to remain anonymous. I come from the old tradition, when everything was done by hand, said Romina Del Sarto, 53, who was working with a small hand tool. Her shoes and even her braid were caked with marble dust. Del Sarto began working in her father's sculpting workshop when she was 17. Everyone lives off marble here, and I'm grateful for the job, she said. But sometimes Carrera feels as if it's losing a part of its history. I found a living link with the fading past in the nearby town of Pietrasanta when one afternoon I visited Enzo Peschini, who has worked only with hand tools since his days as an apprentice more than 70 years ago. He is now 83. Around town, he's known as a master who can carve the most elaborate details into stone. His home is set in a small farm of olive and cherry trees, a vineyard, a fruit orchard, and vegetable and rose gardens. Taped to the wall of his studio was a yellowed photo of Michelangelo's Pietà that he told me has inspired him for much of his professional life. I always worked from beginning to end, from the huge block of marble to the delicate sculpture, he said. Chiseling the block, it's a heavy, heavy job. I was strong when I was young and didn't mind it. His tools include hammers, chisels, saws, rasps, files, and curved steel calipers in several sizes. There are also tools he made himself, such as a hand drill called the violin, that needs two people to make it work. One person holds the handle of the pointed drill, while the other pulls on a string that drives the point to the stone. We used this in the days when there was no electric drill. Peschini has used his skills mainly to help other people produce their sculptures in marble. Among his carving partners was film star Gina Lola Brigida, who went on to become a respected sculptor and photographer after her film career and who died in January 2023. I am not an artist, Peschini said. I'm just an artisan. But he has made his own sculptures, many of which he keeps in his house and studio, a small, refined figurine of a boy fishing, a baby with tiny, delicate fingers, a pack of playing cards. He picked up another tool made of two pieces of wood and a vise held in place with glued in nails. This is my robot, he said. If I want to do something that's good, that's mine, I have to do it the old way. But you have to go with the times. There are fewer and fewer young people who want to do hard physical labor. But machines won't change the sensitivity of the work. You'll always need the sculptor for that. Now we'll pop over to the prologue and begin with an article under Drink. Tipple Play by Taryn White. A Yuletide mainstay continues to warm cockles and ventricles everywhere. In early 1815, distinguished representatives from the United States and Britain gathered in Belgium to ratify the treaty that ended the War of 1812. To celebrate the success of the peace talks, Massachusetts Pittsfield Sun reported, President James Madison's stepson and secretary, John Payne Todd, invited some gentlemen from his country and some others to partake of a liquor with which the Americans used to treat their friends on Christmas Day. That drink was already an American staple, eggnog. The creamy spiced beverage is believed to have originated in medieval Britain as posset, a comforting mixture of hot milk or cream, wine or ale, and spices. In the 13th century, some monks even began adding whipped eggs and figs to their possets. But the scarcity of the more expensive ingredients, including eggs and sherry, made this proto-eggnog a luxury reserved mainly for the British elite. When the beloved drink crossed the continents to North America in the mid-1700s, it became known as egg and grog, a term derived from the Scottish and Gaelic word noggin, which means cup, and grog, an English term for hard booze, often rum. The American colonists soon shortened that to eggnog, a term that first appeared in a poem by Maryland minister Jonathan Boucher around 1774. George Washington was known to serve his own version to guests at Mount Vernon. The drink even once sparked a riot at the United States Military Academy at West Point in 1826, when campus staff intervened after cadets, possibly including a young Jefferson Davis, served eggnog at a boisterous Christmas party despite the school's ban on alcohol. The drink's wintry spices and the preference for serving it hot made nog a Yuletide mainstay. As milk, eggs, sugar, and rum became more affordable and abundant, eggnog became accessible to everyday Americans. Today, people around the world enjoy it, often putting regional spirits on the recipe. Versions include Puerto Rican coquito, which contains coconut milk or cream, and Mexican rompop, which uses egg yolks and a few pinches of baking soda. Despite its origins, eggnog has not always been widely loved in Britain. One contributor to its decline, there is another hot beverage, tea, which took the country by storm in the 17th century when the East India Company began importing it in large quantities. And while eggnog isn't universally loved in the U.S., some Americans loathe it, we nonetheless consume more than 15 million gallons of eggnog annually. That works out to around 240 million cups of eggnog each year, enough to ensure that every adult American can enjoy a seasonal tipple. Also from the past is prologue. We're going to discuss an American icon, The Stuff of Legend by Alice George. A president's forbearance spurred history's most enduring toy craze. A true history of the teddy bear begins in the American wilderness. In December 1902, President Theodore Roosevelt embarked on a hunting trip in Mississippi with one main goal: to bag a black bear. As the tale goes, after Roosevelt had scoured the brush for several days without so much as spotting one, some of his hunting companions corralled an injured old bear and tied it to a willow tree. Here, they said, was Roosevelt's opportunity to slay one and declare victory. Horrified, the president refused, saying it would be unseemly, unsporting, for a man of honor to kill this vulnerable creature. He ordered the decrepit bear to be euthanized, and this odd show of mercy quickly became news. Editorial cartoonist Clifford K. Berryman captured the scene in several Washington Post drawings, one showing a thin Roosevelt refusing to kill a bear, another picturing a more realistically stocky Roosevelt near a smaller bear with a wide-eyed baby-like face. To Brooklyn candy store owner Morris Mitchum, the cute cub from the cartoons also looked like a marketing opportunity. He asked his wife Rose to sew a stuffed version, and that single prototype sold shortly after the couple placed it in the store window. Rose made more, and with demand exceeding what busy fingers could create, the two began factory production in 1903. Mitchum called his cushy new companions Teddy's Bears after the president. By late 1906, the name had shifted to Teddy Bear. At about the same time, the Steiff Company of Gangen, Germany, was coincidentally creating a bear of its own. In 1903, Steiff sold 3,000 of the critters to a New York department store. A year later, Roosevelt, who couldn't abide the nickname Teddy, he had once called it an outrageous impertinence, nevertheless deployed his lovable namesake as a mascot in his re-election campaign, prominently displaying a Mitchum bear at the White House. That helped propel the animal to further fame. In 1906, one Manhattan store sold more than 60,000, and soon even the German maker Steiff adopted the American teddy bear name. Not everyone was enthralled, though. A few social commentators saw teddy bears as ominous. They feared that some girls' preference for soft animals over human-like dolls would become all-consuming, replacing the female urge to nurture babies, and eventually lead to childless marriages. In 1907, the Reverend Michael G. Esper of Michigan warned his congregation that the fad for supplanting the good old dolls of our childhood with the horrible monstrosity known as the teddy bear would lead to falling birth rates. The issue roiled the country, though most did not share Esper's paranoia. A few days after Esper's tirade, Nevada's Reno Evening Gazette ran a piece with the headline, "Teddy Bears Rule Supreme," in which a local woman rebuts Esper. "A teddy bear is only a fad, and I do not believe that it is at all harmful for children to play with them." The nation seemed to agree at a time when a more tolerant, permissive view of childhood was emerging, says Gary Cross, a historian at Pennsylvania State University and author of Kid Stuff, Toys and the Changing World of American Childhood. There was, Cross says, a new willingness to let children remain childlike for a longer period of time. Notably, teddy bears helped launch and feed a growing demand for children's goods, a largely new market in the early 20th century, when child labor was declining. In the next few decades, bears became a source of comfort during turbulent times, even for those long past childhood. Soldiers carried their own teddy bears tucked into knapsacks during both world wars. The bear soon found a welcoming habitat in literature and pop culture. In 1921, English author A.A. Milne gave his one-year-old son a fluffy pal who went on to become the world's most famous bear because he did what every child wanted from their toys. He came to life. After Milne wrote the Winnie the Pooh series, his American publisher, E.P. Dutton, sent the stuffed Pooh on a tour through the U.S., and in 1957, when Elvis Presley performed Let Me Be Your Teddy Bear in the film Loving You, fans expressed their admiration by sending him thousands of stuffed bears. More than a century after their debut, collectors are still bullish on the bears. In November 2022, a 1906 Steiff bear sold for €10,500, around $12,746, a number that did not approach the Steiff Louis Vuitton teddy bear, outfitted in a beret and trench coat with the designer's signature logo, sold in 2000 for $182,550, which still holds the Guinness World Record for a teddy bear sale. The Ideal Toy Company, which the Mitchums founded in 1903, at one point became the biggest doll maker in the U.S. To mark the bear's 60th birthday in 1963, the Mitchum's son, Benjamin, presented an original bear to Roosevelt's grandson, Kermit. Though Kermit intended to donate the critter to the Smithsonian, his children had other plans. "They didn't want to part with it yet," his wife, Belle Roosevelt, confessed. After the children relented a year later, the historic toy finally made it to the National Museum of American History, where it still resides, a reminder of a child's innocence and a president's sportsmanship. Now we'll move on to a short article titled Home Games by Jamie Seaton. Simple toys from past millennia evoke humanity's undying urge to play. Lance Encounter, Germany, Middle Pleistocene, circa 300,000 BC. In the 1990s, archaeologists in Schoningen, Germany, discovered the large-scale record of tools made by Middle Pleistocene humans, including a 30-inch double-pointed lightweight curved stick that was shaped and smoothed into an aerodynamic tool. Archaeologists believe that children in the Middle Pleistocene played with these pointed sticks and thereby developed throwing and hunting skills. In support of this theory, researchers have also noted that in later periods, children in far-flung countries like Chad and Indonesia once played with similar implements. Motion pictures. Ice Age Europe, 16,000 to 9,000 BC. The Upper Paleolithic version of flipbooks. Rondelles are small discs made of bone, antler, or ivory, with an image carved on either side and one or two holes for a cord in the middle. Tug the cord back and forth and the disc swings, giving the illusion of a moving image. One Ice Age example found in France in 1868 shows a doe with her legs tucked under her on one side and extended on the other. So it looks like she's running when the rondelle is swinging. Doll in the family. Roman Empire, circa AD 1 to 400. Since the 1800s, archaeologists have excavated more than 500 doll-like figures from the Roman world. Scholars long thought these were principally used as burial objects. But the extensive wear on the jointed limbs has led archaeologists in recent years to conclude that children did indeed play with these dolls. Toy figures represent adult women were made of ivory or bone, and some even had miniature jewelry and intricately carved hairstyles. Gift horse, Egypt, 250 BC to AD 500. When archaeologists excavated the small ancient farming village of Caranus, Egypt, between 1924 and 1935, they found numerous toy horses. The best preserved has small wheels with a harness and saddle painted on its body. Tiny eye hole in the head may have been used to hold a cord so a child could pull the horse along on the ground. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.